Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 19 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, Steve, we're all familiar with that term space junk, and that refers to those bits and pieces of junk floating around in space. But today we're going to talk about things in a bit more upscale fashion, and by that, we're going to be talking about derelict satellites, which are still out there, but have ceased to function.
And you know, this reminds me of the first two lines of The Arrow and the Song poem by Henry Longfellow, which begins with, I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to earth, I know not where. And formulating the outline of today's topic rapidly took on the chicken and egg guise in that, do we talk about what is debris or space junk, or do we first delve into satellites? Well, you and I know this, Tim, but maybe the listeners don't, that since 1957, it's been estimated there have been over 6,500 successful space launches, placing over 17,000 satellites in orbit. And of that number, 11,500 are still up there. And of those, some 9,000 are still functioning. But first, I've got a small update for the Odysseus Lunar Lander. I found out its nickname Odie, and it soft landed successfully on the moon, marking the U.S.'s return 52 years after Apollo 17. And it's the first time that a commercial company has done so. And there's going to be an awful lot more about soft lunar landings and commercial companies to come. And I believe you've got some updates too, Tim.
I've got one, Steve. It's about the good people at Boeing who've been in the news quite a bit lately for things going wrong with their airlines and also things going wrong with their space program. But this week, NASA introduced two astronauts who will be making a trip to the ISS in April, and their names, Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams. And the news is that they'll be skippering Boeing's Starliner spacecraft. This is the first time that vessel will be used to carry actual astronauts into space. And Steve, suffice to say, this is a bit of a turning point for the company. But the other bit of positive news from Boeing is much more relevant to our topic today about derelict satellites. Boeing has been the leader, I think, in the development or interest in 3D printers in space. And this past week, the company announced some new funding for what's now called additive manufacturing. And in terms of this, it's the Additive Manufacturing Space Lab. For the first time, they're going to be attracting students with an interest in growing this industry using 3D printing technology for the construction of satellite equipment. And the view is to eventually have that technology put to use in space. And for those of us like myself, actually, who have a strong dose of optimism, the talk is that one day the junk that's orbiting our planet might become the input material for those 3D printers that are operating in space.
Well, let's begin today's topic of derelict satellites by examining the very first ones, what their primary purpose was, and what was going to happen to them at the end of their mission. In the very early stages of satellite technology, there was never the intent of boosting decommissioned satellites into higher Earth orbits. It was difficult enough to get a satellite into low orbit, let alone boost it up even higher later on. All early satellites were destined for orbital decay and burn-up upon re-entry. And just as in the poem, nobody knew at the time of launch where they would eventually re-enter. So let's start with Sputnik 1, which holds the distinction of being the world's first satellite launched by the Soviets on October 4th, 1957.
1957. Now that rings an historical bell, doesn't it? It's famous in my mind for the launch of Sputnik, but you have to set it against a rather strange time in the Cold War. Now we look back on Sputnik as a scary time for the West. But ironically, launching that satellite was seen as part of the International Geophysical Year, IGGY as it was known. The hope was to foster international cooperation in 11 Earth science fields, ranging from further examination of cosmic rays to solar activity. And in fact, in terms of solar activity, that was a peak year in terms of the sunspot activity. It was hoped that Iggy, which ran from July of 57 to December of 58, would put a thaw in the Cold War. But of course, the opposite occurred. And in an effort to beat the Americans into space, what the Soviets did was put in an enormous effort creating an ICBM and then modifying it just slightly for non-military use. Sputnik 1's only purpose was to be a small radio transmitter, which would send out a series of beeps, which I think we've all heard, announcing its presence from space, and that was an explicit demonstration of the Soviets' prowess.
As estimated, after 3 weeks, Sputnik's batteries died and the signal ceased, but the satellite remained in orbit for another 9 weeks, completing a total of 1,440 orbits before burning up during reentry. And Sputnik 1 thoroughly shook the American psyche, which might have been greatly allayed had they known that 7 previous Soviet launch attempts failed, but secrecy barred that information while the states openly shared all of their failures.
You know, it was always intended, Steve, that Sputnik 1's elliptical orbit, going from a high of 939 kilometers to a low of 215, would result in a decay due to the upper atmosphere drag, small as it was, but sufficient for the satellite to burn up and re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And by the way, a little shout out to Canada here, as the Dominion Observatory site at Newbrick, Alberta, was the first facility in North America to photograph Sputnik 1. And a hats off to the resident scientists at the time, Art Griffin, for his vigilant efforts.
And the world's second satellite was Sputnik 2, launched a month later into a similar elliptical orbit. And it was the first to carry a living entity into space, a dog named Laika. Sputnik 2 orbited for 5 months, gathering some cosmic ray data, and after completing 2,570 orbits, burned up in re-entry. However, Laika the dog died from heat exhaustion only 5 hours into the mission, creating a huge outcry of animal cruelty.
And well deserved, Steve. 3 months later, the U.S. first satellite, Explorer, launched on January 31st, 1958. It was into a highly elliptical orbit of 358 kilometers by 2,550, far outlasting its planned 4-month duration. And on board, it carried scientific instruments designed to study cosmic rays and transmitted data for an unprecedented 6 years. 12 years later, in 1970, the non-functioning Explorer re-entered and burned up after completing an amazing 58,402 orbits.
And the fourth and last satellite launched during Iggy was Sputnik 3. And unlike its predecessors, it wasn't designed to garner any space first. Rather, it did conduct scientific experiments and gather data about the Earth's upper atmosphere, ionosphere, and cosmic rays. 9 months and 1,400 orbits later, its orbit decayed and it too burned during re-entry.
So, to recap those first satellites, most were launched for prestige, with science taking a decidedly backstage presence. And secondly, nobody really knew how long they would remain communicating with ground stations, and certainly nobody knew when and where they would re-enter and burn up.
Tim, this cavalier approach was quickly recognized as being contrary to public interest and safety. And so in 1972, the Space Liability Convention was enacted, which expanded liability rules first created by the United Nations 1967 Outer Space Treaty. In short, it holds the launching nation responsible for damage caused by space objects such as falling boosters or satellites re-entering.
So, up to 1972, should that metaphorical arrow shot into the air rip through your backyard tent, that would be your hard luck. With culpability now at stake, launching countries had to come up with methods for safely deorbiting satellites.
While researching this topic, I came across the acronym EOL, which stands for End of Life. So companies and countries are anthropomorphizing satellites. And further to that, on a NASA data website, the launch of a satellite is now listed as its birth date. Well, regardless, now when a satellite completes its mission, ground control sends a series of commands to shut down its onboard instruments, end downlinking transmissions, and commit the satellite to its demise.
Okay, so the satellite stops sending signals, but it's still orbiting, and as we know, gravity plays a pivotal part in mission operations and spacecraft disposal. The Earth's gravity is, of course, constantly pulling down everything from orbit, and since all orbits decay, The question still remains, how and when is the satellite re-entry initiated?
When it's time to dispose of a satellite, it can either be pushed further away into space or brought down in a controlled fashion. And doing research on today's topic, I realized there are three basic orbital heights, sort of like onion layers. Now, I admit that's a trite analogy, but hopefully listeners will get the idea. Low Earth orbits are between 100 and 2,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface. Medium Earth orbital paths are between 2,000 and 35,780 kilometers, and high Earth orbits for geosynchronous satellites are above that.
I don't think I can work the onion layer metaphor here, but let's just say for those low Earth orbits, they usually hit the brakes with some kind of braking rockets or thrusters, and that brings the satellite back into our atmosphere, somewhere over the South Pacific, typically over the South Pacific Ocean, midway between Australia and Chile, which is a favorite satellite graveyard.
And yes, but in changing its orbit, the controllers must be aware of the thousands of satellites and their paths to avoid crashing, which would not only destroy a functioning satellite, initiating a costly lawsuit, but also create a cloud of space junk, which we'll get into later.
So for communication satellites that are already in higher geostationary orbits, it's usually easier, and by that I mean less expensive, to thrust them into an even higher supersynchronous or graveyard orbit. Raising the orbit of a decommissioned satellite to this very high altitude means it'll be so far away from functioning satellites and its orbital decay time will be so long, hundreds or thousands of years. And by that time, it'll either be somebody else's worry or new technology will be used.
Speaking about new technology, let's have a quick look at some of those. The U.S. Space Force is eyeing a number of options to extend the life of satellites that have run out of fuel. And at January's Space Mobility Conference held in Orlando, one of those options is described as a jetpack, though of course it's a rocket. It's a small propulsion unit that can be added to existing spacecraft already in orbit. The Space Force deems an on-orbit refueling as an immediate need to be launched and connected to existing satellites to give them more propulsion.
So it's like BCAA, which will come and get your stranded car and fill it up with gas. Pretty clever. The Space Force announces that this type of, quote, sustained maneuverability is a novel key part of its strategy. Rather than launch satellites into a single orbit for their entire lifespan, Space Force states it wants to be able to react to dynamic threats and reposition those satellites for as long as they're operational. This could also include refueling satellites that run out of rocket fuel and are no longer able to move on their own.
And with future military missions in mind, one Space Force general at that meeting said, "Since the dawn of the space age, we've been doing it wrong. What we've really been doing is what I call positional space operations. We launch a platform into orbit and we tend to leave it right there. And that's just not going to be sufficient anymore."
So the Space Force is referring to this sort of refueling service as their, quote, servicing, mobility, and logistics office, unquote. And they will be seeking solutions and technologies from private companies. Now, I didn't realize that for years, multiple government agencies and aerospace manufacturers have actually been developing a variety of approaches for robotic servicing and on-orbit refueling. It's hard to believe I'm saying that. On-orbit refueling. And some of these are approaching technological readiness.
And let's refer to one such company, Northrop Grumman, and it's been commissioned to launch its new, quote, passive refueling module to go on an operational mission in the near future. The PRM was selected to serve as a standard for refueling technologies moving forward. And a company spokesman in January said this, quote, "In an increasingly contested and congested space domain, on-orbit refueling will enable spacecraft to continue maneuvering to engage threats, avoid debris, and extend the life of satellites in geosynchronous Earth orbit."
And I'll bet there's not a listener out there that's aware of this type of venture. You heard it here first, folks, on Space Talks. Now, also in January of this year, the private Japanese Astroscale company was awarded $26 million in a contract by the Space Force to develop a similar satellite refueling spacecraft. Subsequently, Astroscale has signed an agreement with another private company called Orbit Fabs for in-space refueling tankers.
Researching this novel concept has proven to be rather complicated, Tim, but I think this is the skinny. Astroscale has developed LEXI space vehicles, and LEXI is the acronym for Life Extension in Orbit. Hand in hand, the Orbit Fab Company has developed a refueling port known as RAFTI, short for Rapidly Attachable Fluid Transfer Interface. And RAFTI is being offered to government and commercial operators to make their satellites compatible with Orbit Fab's refueling tankers.
I got it. So these gas stations in space, if you might say, will refuel LEXI with a total of, I think it's 1,000 kilograms of xenon propellant, which in turn will service existing operational satellites in geosynchronous orbit, thus extending their lifespan.
I think that's it, Tim. This is so complicated. And LEXI will not only extend life, but after a period of time provide, and I quote, this is hard to believe, end of life services to safely decommission and dispose of defunct satellites.
Well, I can say a prayer to that. Talk about narrowing the human-machine interface gap.
In the second half, let's consider another aspect of satellites and satellite debris, and that's of packaging. And yes, we're going to go all analogous again here. You arrive home with a much-desired brand new appliance. Let's say it's a variable temperature toaster, and you bring it into your house in a bag, which contains some other items which you purchased. You empty the contents onto your counter and place them aside. Now you open the toaster package and peer inside to see the toaster and notice that it's inside a plastic bag, and it's wedged in place with a couple of pieces of cardboard or maybe some styrofoam. So you remove the toaster, and in doing so, notice a warranty card and a set of instructions. Opening the toaster bag, you notice the end of the extension cord is bundled by a piece of plastic-coated wire and also has a safety piece of plastic enclosing the terminals. Finally, you put the unadorned toaster in the center of the counter and take stock of the packaging. Well, there's your original receipt, the bag used to bring home the toaster, the cardboard box, plastic wrapper, additional cardboard or styrofoam, warranty and instruction cards, and finally the extension cord wire and plastic electric prong protector.
So true. Let's get this straight then, Steve. You go to the store to buy a toaster and you arrive home with it, but also, if I've tallied this up correctly, 10 additional bits of stuff, all related to getting you that toaster. And it wouldn't be going far out on a limb to call all of this packing debris. Now, if all you want to do is place one, count them, one satellite in orbit, with current technology, it can't be done so without placing a whole lot of other extraneous things into space orbit. And let's call that debris. It's also up there. Further, it's a fair guess that we're not talking about a simple 10-to-1 ratio as outlined in your excellent toaster analogy. First of all, there's the rocket booster and other stages which put the satellites into orbit in the first place. In the case of SpaceX, they do use reusable boosters, but that's actually not very much the norm. Secondly, there are satellite protective shrouds, which are discarded in space, along with tiny bits of paint debris, and of course, rocket fragmentation debris, should an explosion occur in space.
And these non-functional objects which remain in space are collectively called space debris. But I think the average person simply thinks of them as being space junk.
Mm-hmm. You know, that reminds me of that, I think it was 2010 song, Space Junk by Devo. The line was, on Christmas Eve, said NORAD, a Soviet Sputnik hit Africa. So satellite payload debris includes calibration devices and mission-related objects such as optical lens covers and astronaut tools.
Yes, astronaut tools. Believe this. In 2008, a tool bag was lost in space when ISS astronauts were conducting spacewalk repairs. And another tool bag was lost just this last November. It's still in orbit, and it's expected to burn up in reentry in March of this year.
Yeah, so we're starting to talk about just how much of this problem there is. Now, NASA, NORAD, and the U.S. Space Force track objects in space for the obvious safety and security reasons. So how much is there? The amount of space debris changes on a daily basis, but a recent report listed, catch this, 25,857 artificial objects in orbit above the Earth, including the 5,465 operational satellites.
And that's only accounting those satellites which can be tracked. The Russians invented what they call the Malnaya orbital path to provide surveillance and communications in their far north, and those objects are very difficult to track.
Fine for satellites, but when factoring in space junk, the numbers rise dramatically. So, for instance, data from 4 years ago tracked more than 34,000 pieces that were larger than 10 centimeters, 900,000 pieces that were between 1 centimeter and 10 centimeters, and a spectacular 128 million pieces that were smaller than 1 centimeter. Now, I think most people might be familiar with NASA boss Bill Nelson. He recently stated that space junk is a major problem, causing the International Space Station to change its orbit several times. He's even a paint ship coming in at the wrong angle, the wrong direction at an orbital speed of 28,000 kilometers per hour could damage the space station or fatally wound an astronaut conducting a spacewalk.
Late January of this year, low Earth orbit was the site of a near miss that had the potential to create thousands of pieces of hazardous space debris. Satellite monitoring and collision detection firm Leo Labs spotted a near miss between two defunct Soviet space objects, mainly a rocket body and Cosmos 2361, which was launched in 1998. The two objects missed one another by a mere 6 meters, but had they not done so, the collision would have generated thousands of more pieces of space debris.
Big headaches. The US government has issued its first ever fine. Now, that went to a company for leaving space junk orbiting the Earth when it fined Dish Network $150,000 for failing to move its EchoStar 7 satellite far enough away than had been promised. Now, it was launched back in 2002. EchoStar was in a geosynchronous orbit, and then it died in 2022. At that point, they were supposed to boost it 300 kilometers further into space, but due to a lack of fuel, they could only boost it 120 kilometers.
And I wonder how much of an incentive to comply that $150,000 fine was, since Dish's overall 2022 revenue was a staggering $16.7 billion. But I suppose that the fine may have an impact on other satellite operators, since the US actually used its regulatory powers for the very first time.
I think personally, Steve, it's the Dish would see it as a cost of doing business. I wonder how this will fare for India, which in July of last year confirmed that an object that washed up on a Western Australian beach was from one of its polar satellite launch vehicles. This admission followed the Australian Space Agency's announcing that the object was most likely the third stage of a PSLV. Now, Steve, I'm curious as to how this was determined. I mean, was there a made in India stamp on the debris?
I wonder. Well, apparently there are often serial numbers on components, and it's also possible to identify certain debris based on their appearance. At any rate, Australia said it was working with India's Space Agency to determine next steps, including consideration of obligations under the United Nations space treaties. And what's of greater concern to me, Tim, is the intentional destruction of satellites in orbit with no regard to the amount of inevitable debris.
You're talking about ASATs or anti-satellite missiles. They're designed to destroy an enemy satellite by exploding next to it or directly hitting it in a so-called kinetic kill.
Well, exactly so, Tim. A little bit of history here, as we like to do. In 1985, the United States Air Force conducted its first kinetic kill, targeting one of its own defunct Solwind satellites orbiting at 590 kilometers above the Earth. An F-15 jet fighter nicknamed the Celestial Eagle launched a missile with no warhead, and it hit the satellite with a closing velocity of 24,000 kilometers an hour, and it created over 700 pieces of debris.
About 2007, China conducted an ASAT test, destroying one of its own defunct satellites in low Earth orbit, forcing the International Space Station to boost its orbit to avoid fragments. And in response, the US Navy conducted, quote, Operation Burnt Frost. And in 2008, it destroyed a reconnaissance satellite carrying a tank of toxic hydrazine fuel, which posed potential hazards if it were to have survived re-entry. The explosion created significant space debris and raised concerns about a new military space race, bizarre term. In 2021, Russia conducted its first kinetic kill, which generated hundreds of thousands of bits of debris, endangering astronauts aboard the ISS, some of whom were in fact Russian. And you know, Steve, we would be remiss in this episode if we didn't make mention of the European Remote Sensing 2 satellite, which was purposely deorbited into the Pacific graveyard just last week. So fortunately, there was no additional debris from that one.
You know, we could go on and on about the number of satellites and the increasing amount of space debris, but I really think listeners will be best able to cement this concept by visiting an absolutely amazing website provided by the University of Texas, and it hosts an interactive display of active and inactive satellites, rocket bodies, and debris. And the website address is astria.tac.utexas.edu/astriagraph/. And I know nobody got that, but this episode will be made into a podcast and put onto CKVS's website, and you can go there and find that.
That's all the time we have today on Space Talks. And until next time, this is Tim Woods with a poetic quote from Robert Frost, which goes, and I'm going to try to get my incantation right here, "I wish I may, I wish I might, give Earth another satellite."
Well done. And this is Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.